thing I tend to do for this kind of, do you think this documentary would have been around 10 years earlier or 10 years later?
No.
Would it have had the same audience?
No, I don't think it would have. And I guess, I kind of to your point of that question, like, everything was bigger and better, and that's kind of always the direction we were kind of heading at that time. Like, the 90s were a pretty decent time to be around in, and so maybe it was just like, well, it's great, but we can always improve and be right. better and bigger and all those things. And so I think time and place definitely has a lot to do with why it was successful then, and also why we haven't seen a lot from him since.
Right.
And so, yeah, I would think that that time period says a lot about who we were then.
Right. So I feel like a little bit earlier in the 90s, that's when the supersized thing even showed up on menus.
Right, yeah.
And it was kind of a big deal.
Right.
And it actually was a big deal in the story. Yeah, it was a good deal, too.
Well, yeah, and everything was a deal.
Yeah,
right.
and it was like a sign of a really good economy that, you know, these places were. And the audience of fast food has traditionally been usually lower income families.
Yeah.
You know, and McDonald's was able to do something, and all these restaurants were able to do things that, welfare programs.
I think that the critic, where The Simpsons is a general satire, this family satire, people can relate to it. The critic is a little bit more nuanced. I think it's geared towards the person who wants a little bit more, you know, poking fun, a little bit more, I don't want to say rough humor or rough satire, but just more nuanced. Like, the people who appreciate random humor, right?
Yeah.
Not that The Simpsons doesn't have that kind of thing.
But they take it to a new level on the critic.
Yeah.
It's, you know, The Simpsons started that trend in their writing of referencing something, doing the quick cutaway, and you might see it. Later on, Family Guy took that, and that became the basis for their whole show, basically. It was, remember the time, they would flashback, cut away, and see the little thing that they're referencing. King of the Hill rarely actually did a cutaway. They would reference things, but just kind of leave it at that.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, it made it that much funnier, because, like, remember that time I wrote that hymn? You know, and just like, what? And like, I would like to hear that story, but you just left it there and for my imagination. I think you said it perfectly. The Simpsons is relatable because it's a family. You know, 2.5 kids, man, you know, working class guy, stay-at-home mom, very relatable to a late 80s, early 90s, middle America. Jay Sherman's a film critic in New York. There's probably about 12 people in the entire globe at that time that... even less that had TV audience. So it's not a relatable character through their occupation, but relatable in that the way he sees media and that he does not like most things, that he is highly critical. And for a 90s audience, I mean, that tells us something about the time period, is that that was really when our media was hitting almost overload status. You know, at the beginning of the century, we had the rise of mass media with film, of course, and radio, and then magazines in the 20s, and really taking off there.
Really sit in the pocket and have his groove when Yeah came out. Like, the song was all over the airwaves.
I can still hear it now.
I know.
Like, it just was
I'm
on.
Hearing,
I was like, yeah.
I know. That's me, too.
And it's like, you can't even make a song like that as a new artist.
Mm-hmm.
You have to build up at least some credibility as an actual musician and entertainer.
And he was paying his dues. I mean, he left home. He was like a Chattanooga, Tennessee boy. So he left there to go and get tutelage under P. Diddy, who's also controversial right now, but under Puffy, and he was being like mentored and to come into something like this. So it worked. The mentorship worked, but he had to make a lot of sacrifices. He left his family, he left his hometown so that he can get to that point.
Do you think that he could kind of read the scene in the late 90s or so, that he knew that if he worked hard enough and his raw talent, that he would emerge as somebody who could just refer to themselves as one name and sell albums to the platinum level or records with a single word on the title? Do you think he saw that?
I know that to some extent he had to, because he was working towards it with, you know, at a feverish pace.
Yeah.
So I think to some extent he had to know it. Don't know how much, but yes, he definitely had to know that. because he was putting a lot of legwork and he was putting in the work.
Yeah. And that era is early, early downloading of music time period. I think iTunes was probably just arriving in the early 2000s.
I think they probably was still burning CDs and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It was like, I can still... Well, and it's funny because earlier today we were talking with... I was talking with somebody else about the movie or the documentary Super Size Me.
This
is black and white because it's easier to mask, you know, the different issues you might have. But to put him with these very famous people, presidents, that was cutting edge. Why do you think, or what does that tell you about the 90s as far as in our society and our culture then, and maybe even our economics then, that there was that much of... so deliberate to make it so accurate that they didn't just rely on, because they could have done all this stuff with actors that kind of looked like JFK.
Yeah.
They could have done that without any of the actual footage. Why was that such an important component to the movie by the 1990s?
If you don't mind. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we were entering that, getting into that digital age, leaving the analog age into the digital age, and people were becoming more apt to want to see that perfection, but also too the fact that people were more familiar with what these individuals looked like. The age of television allowed for the world to open up and actually see who these individuals are. If somebody's like, that's not President Kennedy, doesn't look anything close, they're not going to buy into it.
Right.
So I think that that made a big difference, people being more familiar with who these people were, what they sounded like. I think that was an important part of it.
I remember watching the movie as, and yes, it is a regional base. I mean, it does have a lot to do with, you know, Alabama. You know, they make up a place, Greenbow, Alabama, right? It's, you know, the book takes place in Mobile, but it's like they have that connection. He keeps going back there as his home base throughout the story. In the movie more than the book, but, you know, he keeps going back there. But it's still a collective story for people of his generation. And so I remember watching it with my parents as almost like a... And they didn't say it this way, but they put it up there as like, this is our story. You know, they were born in the 40s.
We talk about origins here, of having a large breakfast with bacon and eggs comes directly from Kennedy, Harry, New York. And the story is pretty cool. The story goes that the sale of bacon at Beechnut was on a downslide. It was decreasing rapidly. So like, what do we do? You know, we have all these people hired. We're losing tons of money. How do we make bacon sales go up? So what they ended up doing is they hired a marketing director, called 10 doctors, and said, hey, would having a big breakfast or no breakfast be better? They said, oh, big breakfast. And 9 out of 10 doctors did that. So he ended up marketing that in magazines all over and saying, hey, you pair eggs and bacon. It says 9 out of 10 doctors say a big breakfast is much better than no breakfast at all. And it, the rest is history.
And it was all from Beechnut saying, what do we do with the surplus bacon?
Correct. And if you actually, if you Google the origins of breakfast, bacon and eggs, having bacon for breakfast, it'll go right back to Beechnut, and it's all over now. I know, I can't remember if it was the History Channel or the Science Channel. Did an episode, Food That Built Made America, I think was on it too, that talks about the origins of that.
And gets its credibility that way.
Right.
And it's, I just want to talk about that for just a moment, because that's such an interesting series. That, you know, because History Channel has done lots of, you know, just did you know kind of stuff. And that, I was talking just earlier with a woman about the Super Size Me documentary from 2004, and how there was like an awareness, I think, around 20 years ago about food and putting it into our, you know, what we ingest and his wealth and comfort to go off, and his status in France to go off and potentially lose his life over somebody else's, his cause. So that seems to have stayed with him, that he remained rather humble throughout all
this.
He
did remain humble. And it's just, I think it speaks to the character of the man, because he was very involved in caring about freedom at a young age, even at 13, an article he wrote that his favorite kind of a horse would be the horse that bucked the rider off, because it was independent and had a mind of its own. That he valued that at a young age. And at seven, he got married at 16 to Adrienne. She was 14 at the time. So his father-in-law had a a dragoon, and he led some of the troops there. And he was doing that at 17. At 18, he wanted to come to America. King Louis the 16th said, no way. He signed up anyway. He got a commission, but they had the Continental Congress had no money to pay him. He said, that's okay. I'll pay my own way. He bought a boat when he was 18, came to America, and was leading troops under George Washington at 19. Wow. So I think, you know, we sometimes sell our teenagers short, that they're really adults who just need more experience. And I just think he's somebody everyone can look up to, yeah, including our teens, our next generation.
And utilize more diverse sources, because he just sort of is going on what had existed. And that's why what sort of really inspired me as well, there's a documentary, and if anybody gets a chance to watch it, it's not available fully streaming in the United States, but it pops up. It's called The Six, and it's about the six Chinese survivors of the Titanic, because if you actually look at the ship manifest, the group with the largest survival rate were these Chinese sailors, because there was eight of them and six fully survived. And if you think about that percentage-wise of any immigrant group, it was huge. And in this documentary, a big thing they talk about is that they survived partially because they didn't speak English, so when they heard the warnings people were being told in third class to stay down, they just were like, we know what, we're sailors, we know what ice smells like, and they got into the ships. And that, you know, I discovered that through this documentary, but then also if you look at the U.S. Inquit trials, which as teachers, it's so great to use. I love having students play act, because you can get it's like a play script, the transcripts of the United States Senator Smith, this guy from Wisconsin was doing these Senate hearings at the same time they were making all these new immigration laws. So one of the things they were trying to talk about is like, sort of there's all these desirable immigrants who died on the ship. There's all these Finnish and Swedish immigrants. And again, even in talking about that, you're cutting out all the people of color on board. But it was in this inquiry trial that you heard about these Chinese passengers, because he talks about how these Chinese sailors were, you know, some of the people who survived, because all the people who testified were only first class passengers and crew members. Yeah. And I think there was one Irish third class, but they didn't have anyone. There was like maybe one woman who testified, and that was Lucille Duff Gordon, who's like basically invented the fashion show.
Oh, really?
Yes, which is a whole like conversation. She invented the runway fashion show, and her husband, Sir Cosmo Duff Gordon.